This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Film remakes introduce a new audience to beloved old material, and when done right, a new generation can fall in love all over again. Remakes can also elevate mediocre movies to a new level of greatness. But when badly executed, film remakes have been known to butcher a cherished classic. On this edition of Movies on the Radio, we talk about the good, the bad, and the ugly of the film remake. And here to help us are film experts Marcia Gordon and Laura Boies. Marcia is a film professor at North Carolina State University. Hello, Marcia.
Hello, Frank.
And Laura Boies is film curator at the North Carolina Museum of Art. Laura, welcome back.
Thank you, Frank.
Well, let's stay with you for a moment. The fundamental question, why remake? I mean, there are a lot of reasons, right, that a director or a studio might want to remake a film, right? So what are some of them?
Well, the number one is money. I mean, that's what the film industry runs on. Mm-hmm. And if they have a title that has some name recognition that they think they can drag people into the theater with a not so great remake before it's discovered the quality of the film that they are releasing, they'll do it. It's, I think, very rare for an excellent movie to be remade excellently.
And keep in mind, in the early years of film, of at least story film in this country, stories were not owned. People could just pirate whatever stories and everyone could be making film versions of the same thing. But once those copyright laws started being applied, then the producers had to buy the rights to something. So once you owned them, then there was a financial reason to think about reusing a property over and over again. So, for example, Wizard of Oz, there's a bunch of film versions of The Wizard of Oz from the 1910s, for example. So the one we know, of course, is from 1939. So that was just a property that was owned and sold and bartered and so on.
Yeah, and Shakespeare, the famous remake guy of all time, none of those plots were his, right? But he made them the ones we remember. And so that's the key to this, because sometimes you talk about money being the motive, and to some extent, if the film was great and you assume that people liked it, let's do it again. But in many cases, a director will totally overhaul. They'll take some of the theme and overhaul the film, and so I guess they're not really expecting people to like it the second time around.
I think a perfect example of a really well done overhaul and an interesting one is Scarface, which started off as this 1930s Al Capone based story by Howard Hawks, and then of course was redone by Brian De Palma with Al Pacino. So it went from Chicago to Miami, Italian to Cuban, and they're both really wonderful films in their own ways. And I think oftentimes the directors that end up kind of altering the context, really changing the focus of the story to do something of their own with it, end up having the most success with remakes.
Of course, there is kind of a blurry line between remakes and sequels sometimes. Mm-hmm. Like, who can tell the difference between all the Pirates of the Caribbean movies? They are sort of blurred into one
who
long
sees them
franchise.
The other
well, I started out seeing them. Mm-hmm. I've sort of given up.
Well, but the other thing is, too, is themes that seem to be just made for films. The caper flick, of course, is one that's redone over and over again in a thousand different ways, and we seem to have an endless appetite. Here's an example.
This is Chris Kennedy. I'm calling from Nightdale, and my choice for best remake is Ocean's 11. Ocean's 11 is such a fabulous remake because they put together the outstanding ensemble cast, just like they did in the original, but the film aged very well, really reflected modern Las Vegas, as well as being able to transition out of the musical portion of the original into a much more hip version.
Gentlemen, the 3,000 block of Las Vegas Boulevard, otherwise known as the Bellagio, the Mirage, and the MGM Grand. Together, they're three of the most profitable casinos in Las Vegas. This is the vault at the Bellagio. It's located below the Strip, beneath 200 feet of solid earth. It safeguards every dime that passes through each of the three casinos above it. And we're gonna rob it.
I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
Say we get into the cage and through the security doors there, and down the elevator we can't move, and past the guards with the guns, and into the vault we can't open.
Without being seen by the cameras.
Oh, yeah, sorry, I forgot to mention that.
Yeah, well, say we do all that. We're just supposed to walk out of there with $150 million in cash on us without getting stopped?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's that easy. Oh. Chris Kennedy talking about Ocean's 11, his pick. Marshall, let's talk about the original, the Rat Pack, right? Starred in that movie, Sammy Davis Jr., Dean Martin, Frank Sinatra, Angie Dickinson, and again, more music in that. But that was an ensemble cast that everybody wanted to see.
Yeah, and so I think this is an interesting example for a couple of reasons. One is, yes, these are like superstars of pop culture at the time in the 1960s, and it's the kind of same thing when Soderbergh remade the film in 2001, right? A lot of the real heavy hitter performers of the day. This film, it's a caper film. It's fun. It's playful. I mean, this is not a serious film in any way. But I think if you look at them as timepieces, they're kind of perfect reflections of their moment in terms of celebrity culture and in terms of style. And so that's what I think makes these a particularly interesting pairing.
Well, the Rat Pack was the epitome of 1960s cool, and it was a way for the audience to experience that, even if they never would go to Las Vegas. And now everybody goes to Las Vegas, but they still feel that they can have something of that essential cool.
And it was really playing with getting a kind of little glimpse at these people's personalities, even if they were performing roles, this idea of kind of getting access to their kind of hipster behind the scenes life in some ways.
Right.
And it's the perfect kind of remake, too. Again, I think the caper flick is one that, as I said earlier, I think there's an endless appetite for it. You throw the right
stars.
Well,
I have an endless appetite for that.
I do too, and they're silly. But I just you've got me, especially if you have the right stars and the right dynamic and the right magnetism. Yeah, and you get it. They're all trying to get into the elevator that you can't get down, and the guys with the guns, and we're going to walk out. And the guy says, yeah.
Yeah, but, you know, I didn't see it, but I know one of the ones that came up in some of our discussions included the Pink Panther, mm-hmm. which I didn't see. Did you see the most recent iteration of that?
I think I did.
I heard it was absolutely terrible. Yeah.
And
you know,
I really love Steve Martin, right?
Yeah,
he's fantastic.
Yeah, so I mean, it's not.
But I didn't think the original Pink Panther was funny either. The timing was way too slow.
I differ with you on that.
Well, let's get to one that we all might agree on, or not.
My name is Stephen Goldstein, and I'm calling from Asheville, North Carolina. My nomination for the worst remake was the Coen Brothers' 2004 version of The Ladykillers. The film probably should not have been shot in color. I think part of the strength of the original was that it was black and white, and you were focused much more on the very funny storyline and terrific performances. Also, transplanting the location to the United States, and particularly throwing Tom Hanks in as an unfortunately not very successful fake Southerner just seemed to take away the authenticity of the film for me.
Well, what about all that money?
The money? Well, the money is Mr. Pancakes.
That's right.
Who only just remortgaged his home in order to raise the money for a surgical procedure that will correct the wandering eye of his common-law wife, Mountain Water, who suffers from stevia, strabismus, and a general curdling of the vitreous jelly.
I had seen the original film when I was living in England in the early 1970s and was charmed by yet again a number of other simple, very amusing Alec Guinness comedies.
Oh, but it's quite ridiculous.
Before you speak, Mrs. Wilberforce, has it occurred to you to wonder why five such men as ourselves should have been driven to this? Why we should risk apprehension, public humiliation, disgrace? There is not one amongst us who is not burdened with responsibilities to others. Major, tell her. Tell her your own story.
No.
Please, Claude, tell her.
Well, it's just that, well, at this very moment, Mrs. Wilberforce, there is waiting an invalid, a dear, sweet little old lady, not may heaven bless her, not unlike yourself, waiting with patient serenity, but with high hope that she has nothing more to fear.
I planned the robbery, Mrs. Wilberforce. I wanted to help them.
That's a clip from Lady Killers, the original 1955, remade in 2004. What was that accent that Tom Hanks was? Where is he from?
I don't know. I mean, these films both have kind of odd tones to start off with, and they have some kind of tongue-in-cheek qualities. But I think what's interesting about what the caller had to say about this is it brings up an idea that we talked about a lot when we did the show on adaptations, which is the extent to which people expect a certain fidelity to the original if it is a beloved film, and to kind of desecrate that, to deviate from that in some way, to change it, Unless it's really, really successful, that becomes a very easy target for criticism, which is not to say that fidelity in and of itself is adequate. I think of that adaptation of remake of Psycho that Gus Van Sant did, mm-hmm. which was a shot-by-shot remake of like one of the great films of all time by Alfred Hitchcock, and it was like, why did we even bother having this film? So it's not just a matter of it being the same, but it's a very easy thing to critique if it's not, and it does not come off as a good
film. This particular film, though, Coen Brothers, you know, famous for just turning out great stuff, unexpected casting, but this one did seem to be a bit of a stinker.
Not every Coen Brothers film is a home run, as this proves. But they like jumping around in different genres. Yeah. They do not want to be pigeonholed and transposing a British comedy to the South maybe seemed like an inspired idea, but in fact it wasn't.
But I really trust the Coen brothers, and I like that they were working with this kind of ensemble cast idea that they like to do over and over again. But I did not think this was a tremendous failure the way that the caller believes, and maybe my compatriot over here.
Well, I actually have not seen it because I was afraid to see it for that remake phobia, because the British version is so delicately hilarious. And
couldn't believe Tom Hanks for a minute, not a single minute.
No, I don't think that he was meant to be particularly believable either. I think that line about between satire.
He was a liar. Looked like a liar.
Right.
Laura Boyes, film curator at the North Carolina Museum of Art. Marcia Gordon, film professor at NC State. We're talking about famous remakes, good and bad. And our conversation will continue on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, talking with film experts Laura Boyes and Marcia Gordon. Laura is the film curator at the North Carolina Museum of Art. Marcia is a film professor at NC State, and we're talking about the best and worst remakes, and we were talking about comedy remakes before the break, so let's keep that going right here.
My name is Carrie Colleton, and I'm calling from Raleigh, and my choice of remake is Father of the Bride. The original with Spencer Tracy and Elizabeth Taylor was the one I saw first when I discovered, those classic movie stars. So that one sticks out in my head as the perfect one.
I used to think that marriages were simple affairs. Boy meets girl, fall in love, they get married, have babies. Eventually, the babies grow up and meet other babies. And they fall in love, and get married, and have babies, and so on.
At my wedding and my place.
Hey, don't understand. What did you mean by
that? No one has to do anything. When the time comes, I'll do everything. I mean everything.
Oh, I wouldn't go to your wedding. Now, not if you're begging.
Now, look here.
I don't care if
fuck you. Fuck me. Now, look here, young man. If you insist upon a church wedding, you can count me out. I wash my hands of the whole affair.
But the Steve Martin remake was really well done for its time, and it really speaks to its time and its comedy, as you would imagine from Steve Martin, and I thought that was really well done too. So while my heart is with Spencer Tracy as the Father of the Bride, I think Steve Martin is a close second.
Excuse me, sir, what are you doing?
I'll tell you what I'm doing. I want to buy 8 hot dogs and 8 hot dog buns to go with them. But no one sells 8 hot dog buns. They only sell 12 hot dog buns. So I end up paying for 4 buns I don't need. So I am removing the superfluous buns.
I'm sorry, sir, but you're gonna have to pay for all 12 buns. They're not marked individually.
Yeah. You wanna know why? Because some big shot over at the Wiener Company got together with some big shot over at the Bun Company and decided to rip off the American public. Because they think the American public is a bunch of trusting nitwits. Well, they're not ripping off this nitwit anymore, because I'm not paying for one more thing I don't need. George Banks is saying no!
Who's George Banks?
Me!
Gary Collington talking about the comedy film Father of the Bride, originally came out in 1950, based on a 1949 novel. We can talk about that in a minute. The remake, of course, 1991.
Well, I agree with Carrie that both of these films, I think, are mm-hmm. excellent. And they do speak to the wedding tradition of their time, because weddings do reflect cultural phenomenon of the day. And I have to say, there's something about Steve Martin's emotions in this movie when he thinks back, you know, on his little girl, and he sees her as a girl sitting at the table. I've met somebody that I'm going to marry, Daddy. It's like I just start crying right away because, you know, this is when you have children, they do seem to grow up that fast. So.
Well, I also think it's interesting to think about people who come to films and the order they come to them. Right. I mean, that Carrie started with the original and then saw the later version. I'm sure there are a lot of people who have seen, you know, their first experience was the 1991 right. version with Steve right. Martin, and then to go back and see the Spencer Tracy version, which, I mean, they're such different actors. They both have such strong qualities as performers, and I think this role is perfect for both of them. And that's really interesting, too, to think about how much this has to do with casting and with personality.
Right. And something you said earlier, too, they're time capsules. So the idea right. that, okay, everybody loved that film in 1941 because that's what marriage looked like, but it's changed so much. What better way to talk about the changing, you know, role of marriage than to update this film?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely
true. And this is a film, I wouldn't surprise me if 10 or 20 years from now it's remade again. I think certainly those situational cultural films that are those kind of touchstone time capsule ideas, they are the easiest, I think, to imagine being reframed in a different time and place.
Well, we're going to take a turn to a different genre here, and we're going to talk about the movie The Thing. Maybe you can give us a little bit of a setup, Laura, you know, and tell us more about the movie The Thing.
Well, this was a movie from 1951. I'm looking at my notes here.
Yeah, 51 and then remake in 82.
Yes, directed by Howard Hawks, and it fits very firmly into the sort of post-nuclear anxiety monster movie genre. And then it was updated in the 80s.
70s, I think.
Nope.
It was
1982. So the original in 51 and the
with
remake.
With Kurt Russell, and then updated one more time very recently.
Oh, you mean there was a third one?
Yes, a third one.
Okay, so the last one was in 82. Well, here's what this listener had to say about it.
My name is Adam Hart. I teach film studies at NC State, and I'm calling from Raleigh. My pick for greatest remake would be The Thing by John Carpenter. I love the original, the Howard Hawks production from the 50s that really started the monster movie craze. It's a sort of tough-minded monster movie in which they fight a giant alien carrot. But the remake is kind of suffused with 80s paranoia in which the alien may be any one of the men in the Arctic station in which it takes place. The effects are amazing and amazingly gross. And the... The atmosphere of dread and uncertainty is remarkable and really powerful.
How many am I looking for?
Five.
There's three and four. You said there were five?
Hope you're enjoying your lunch. Adam Hart picked The Thing as the best remake. And for the record, The Thing was redone in 2011, but the John Carpenter version made in 1982, and an original came out in 51.
I loved watching Laura get so terrified during just listening to that.
What I was appreciating was the way the sound went back and forth between my headphones.
Right.
I was a sound mix that I never would have.
Actually, that's just a short in your cable, but okay. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
That's what they're calling it. So right. I'm really glad that Adam called in and picked this one. I mean, this is an important film for me. This is the first really scary movie I ever saw, and it is perfectly done. I mean, it just has every element of the jumps and the screams and the chills and all of that stuff. And it is, I mean, the Hawks film is, you know, it is what it is. This is not a masterpiece by any stretch of the imagination. But I think in terms of the horror genre, that the Carpenter thing is just completely masterful. And it took, I mean, that carrot that got transformed into this thing. I mean, that is such a leap, and the atmosphere of the kind of Arctic climate. I mean, it's just a fantastic. It's an update in every way.
Yeah. It's also the heyday of the special effects that are done in three dimensions.
Yeah.
You know, that the actors are actually interacting with, not, you know, green screens and CGI and all that. It really, I think, ups the amount of terror.
The effects were
when it's palpable.
Yeah, they were really good in this. I mean, I have to say, in that particular version, like, whether or not you love those sort of action films, you have to admire not only the sound design, but also, and you know, yeah, the sound design was kind of delightful, but the effects really work. They're scary and they're grisly.
Yeah, and just the scenario of people being isolated in a space creates such incredible tension.
Well,
right.
That's the old dark house.
It's
that goes,
the old dark house,
goes
right,
back
wherever
to
it is.
But gets back to the idea that these themes never die, and the idea of what are we afraid of in the 80s, what are we afraid of in the 2000s, again, just apply that to the format, which, getting back to Shakespeare, it's precisely what he did. Let's dust off this old Scottish king, shall we, and see what we can learn if I apply a little psychology. Well, let's take a listen to this next example of a film and a remake.
My name is Cole Phillips. I'm calling from Cary, North Carolina, and my choice for worst remake is M. Night Shyamalan's The Last Airbender. I think that the cartoon it was originally based on is one of the best cartoon shows I've ever seen from a storytelling standpoint. It has characters that are honorable and brave and courageous. They face real struggles and have real relationship challenges. And in the end, it becomes a show about good versus evil on the same kind of level as Lord of the Rings. I think the movie took that material and, through poor character choices, poor portrayals of the struggles and the complexities of the world that it's based in, just left me feeling disheartened and empty by it. It was a horrible movie-going experience.
Cole Phillips reviewing The Last Airbender remake. What do you think?
Well, I didn't see either of these things, but I think the point is partly a bad movie is a bad movie. No matter what the source material is, mm-hmm. You can take the best source material. And this is the true of any kind of adaptation from literature to film as well. You can take the best story in the world, but if it's not a great film on its own, it's just not a great film.
Well, there's this whole new thing where they're trying to make feature films out of television shows. Baywatch is the latest thing that's being inflicted upon us on the big screen. And for me, the very worst TV show adaptation was the big screen version of The Man from U.N.C.L.E., which was a show that I loved, and they totally didn't get it, and it infuriated me. So.
Well, and Cole, to be fair, he said he did like the original. I mean, it was not a bad story, that the storytelling in the cartoon series. So again, and we talked about this earlier too, many of these films actually began, Maltese Falcon, we'll talk about that in a minute, you know, started out as books, so you have to even skip genres. Let's go to another example here, and this one is RoboCop. There have been a couple of those.
Hello, my name is Michael Bazemore. I'm calling from Wake Forest, North Carolina, and my pick for best remake is the 2014 remake of RoboCop. I love the original RoboCop so much, it's hard to describe, and I was skeptical when the new version came out, but I thought that the new version was pitch perfect for 2014 in the same way that the version in 1987 was. 2014, they avoided making a pitch perfect or beat for beat remake of the movie, and in doing so, they made the best version that could be made in 2014. They dealt with our fears about militarization of the police, about the use of drones. They dispensed with the humanity of RoboCop early on.
Holy Christ. Holy Christ. Holy Christ, there's nothing left.
Your body may have gone, but you're still here.
Whereas the original dealt with consumerism, the new one dealt with the fragmentation of media with its Glenn Beck-like commentator. And so what comes across is a movie that, like all good science fiction, speaks to the tenor of the time.
When the machine fights, the system releases signals into Alex's brain, making him think he's in control. But he's not. It's the illusion of free will.
I've selected 13 targets all wanted for murder.
This is the future of American justice.
RoboCop.
I mean, that was such an articulate, a commentary on it. I don't feel like I really need to say anything more than, yeah, that's exactly what a really good remake does. And I actually, I've only seen the Verhoeven film. I haven't seen the 2014, but that made me want to go out and see it.
Good stuff. Let's go to the phones now, because Ralph is on the line and he would like to talk to us about his favorite remake. Ralph, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. I wish I could be as articulate as the previous caller, but I would have to say that I think True Grit, the remake, was much better than the original. I'm sorry to say something negative about John Wayne and his only Oscar, but the acting in the remake was better than the original, and I'm not really sure that John Wayne didn't get the Oscar for the original just because he was who he was and he'd never won anything.
Yeah, it was at the end of his career, but that's me. Thanks, Ralph. Well, what do you think about that? True Grit?
I thought that they were both kind of good films in their own right, but John Wayne, I don't think of as the greatest actor of his or anybody's generation. I mean, I think he had a certain charisma, and obviously he played certain roles very well, but yeah, I don't think of that as like a masterful role, and yet I do think that the remake of it was really well done.
You wonder if they didn't create a role for that. In other words, write that first or direct that movie around John Wayne at the end of his career, and the second time around say, wait a minute, what was this movie really about?
Right.
Making for perhaps a better
film.
Even
though they were very close versions
of each
other.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Let's listen to another one here, The Secret Life of Walter Mitty.
This is William Dodge calling from Raleigh. My pick for... one of my favorite remakes is The Secret Life of Walter Mitty, the newer version, and Stiller. I grew up as a kid watching the original Danny Kaye film, which was always super relevant for me. I always had a highly active imagination, and I was envisioning myself in really kind of fantastic adventures. While the Danny Kaye one was super important to me as a child, it was kind of really kind of hokey, campy.
Well, honey, you weren't thinking of taking Queenie along. I was only asking.
Well, I wouldn't dream of leaving Queenie.
Queenie and Walter don't trust each other. That's the reason they don't get along.
Well, she always starts. You see?
Oh, Queenie, you old draws catch.
I think the thing that was so really great about that remake is it's not a remake of the exact same movie. It's a completely different storyline, but it's done in such a really kind of thoughtful and kind of elegant way that it still keeps the soul of the original short story, which it's based off of, but makes it relevant in modern times.
Where do we land?
We don't. Hey, Walter, just jump in the boat.
What do you mean, jump into the boat? It looks far away.
You gotta go now. Go, 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 go. No, 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 Walter! I'm at the other boat! The little boat!
Oh my God, that really happened. Real face. Sorry for bombing your face.
Secret Life of Walter Mitty, as chosen by William Dodge.
So I remember being really fond of that James Thurber story growing up, and I remember watching that. I don't know why that film, it was on television all the time when I was growing up, and I just could hardly watch it. It was so irritating to me.
Well, it could be Danny Kaye, because he has a way of...
And it was, but it also, it was just goofy instead of it being about a dreamer who was like escaping from... And so I think that the Stiller version kind of recaptures, I think, some of the spirit of the story, actually, that was lost in the first iteration of
it. Well, the Danny Kaye version is totally a star vehicle. It's like how to make, you know, give him the opportunity to play as many different characters, you know, in the form of one movie. And the Ben Stiller version is much more about that gap between you know, follow your dreams and the inability to follow your dreams if you're going to live an average
life. Yeah, and it is curious because it was a star vehicle exactly, but there's this kind of song and dance band quality about the way Danny Kaye plays it, which is kind of works against the character of Walter Mitty, who doesn't really attract the spotlight.
Right.
And so, I mean, I do think that it was kind of an odd casting there, although you can imagine people showing up because it has its own charm, as Danny Kaye did, too.
Oh, he was a big star.
Yes, of course.
Actually, if somebody could explain Danny Kaye's stardom to me.
I don't
understand
it. That glint. He had a glint.
Okay.
Right. See, in that spot there, I'm talking to Laura Boyes and Marcia Gordon. Laura, film curator at the North Carolina Museum of Art. Marcia's a film professor at NC State. We're talking about best and worst remakes on the state of things today. It's Movies on the Radio, and there's more to come. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio. Movies on the Radio today, Laura Boyes and Marcia Gordon talking about best and worst remakes. So we're talking about how a remake should be, you know, whether or not it's going to be faithful to the original. I want to do an A-B comparison here because I think one of the quintessential remakes in terms of a conversation piece would be The Maltese Falcon. Let's listen.
My name is Todd Berliner, and I'm a professor of film studies at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington, and I'm calling from Wilmington. My pick for the best remake is 1941's The Maltese Falcon, directed by John Huston and starring Humphrey Bogart. It's, in fact, the second remake of a 1931 film called The Maltese Falcon. The first remake was 1936's Satan Met a Lady, and both the first Maltese Falcon and the remake, the 1936 remake, were just awful, bland, silly movies. But the second remake, the one that everybody knows, is one of the most beloved movies. And John Huston and Humphrey Bogart and the other artists on that film took a more serious approach to the novel. It's almost a scene-by-scene remake of the 1931 version, but every scene is much more interesting, partly because of the acting, but also because of the visual style, and also the kind of serious approach that Huston took to the original material. People complain about remakes. People often say that they're a sign that Hollywood lacks imagination, but I don't think there's anything wrong with them. There's many great artworks that are remakes, including Shakespeare's Hamlet and King Lear and many other Shakespeare plays.
All right, that's Todd talking about The Maltese Falcon. Glad he made that point about Shakespeare. But this one's got a long history. And again, one of the ones that jumped genres because it came originally from a book, remade several times. Marcia.
Yeah, Dashiell Hammett and James Cain and all those guys who were writing that hard-boiled stuff at this period were very popular and very difficult in some ways to even get made into films at a time when they were being regulated. But I think one of the interesting things is that the first version of this film was a pre-code film. So it was before Hollywood was really regulating itself rigorously. Which happened after 1934, but that doesn't seem to impact the quality of the film. I mean, I think we sometimes have this romantic idea that, oh, when there's no scrutiny, no regulation, you know, things were better, but that's not necessarily true because clearly that the Bogart version is the
stronger
version.
It's the difference between Humphrey Bogart and Ricardo Cortez.
Yes.
Well, and John Huston, too. I mean, you might argue.
But that's his first film, if I'm not mistaken,
yes,
his directorial debut.
Yes.
So this is an untested director turning this into gold.
Well, let's listen. We're gonna play sort of matching scenes. They're taken from different sections, but it's essentially the same scene. This is the Fall Guy scene from The Maltese Falcon. Here it is in 1931.
There's an angle to this deal you've all overlooked.
And what is that, sir?
We've got to have a fall guy.
A fall guy?
Certainly. We've got to feed the police a victim. Somebody they can stick for those three murders.
You're not a man that worries about a little trouble, sir. You'll manage that.
Oh. Well, you skipped to New York or China or someplace, huh? Well, I'm in business here, remember that. This is my town and my racket, and I know what's best for us. Gutman, we're sunk unless we hand over a fall guy.
Well, none of us exactly qualifies for the part, sir. Why, I feel toward Wilmer exactly as if he were my own son.
Well, you can easily pick another son, but there's only one blank for
that. If your scheme were practical, which it isn't, what would prevent Wilmer from telling the police about the Falcon and all of us?
Oh, we can have him shot for resisting arrest.
That's from the 1931 version of The Maltese Falcon. And
I almost fell asleep listening to that.
Yeah, because, first of all, you've got a detective who's in complete charge, right? The fat man is just sort of following along, right? And that I think that also talks to Sidney Greenstreet's role in the 41 version, not only Humphrey Bogart. But, yeah, I mean, it was just sort of reading the lines, right?
Yeah.
Well, also in some of those very early talkies, they spaced out the dialogue because they thought people wouldn't be able to understand if dialogue overlapped at all, so that it makes some of those movies
it's
have a much slower pace. Yeah.
Well, let's listen to the roughly the same scene in the 1941 version with Sidney Greenstreet and, of course, Humphrey Bogart.
If you start something, I'll make it a matter of your having to kill me or call it off.
That's an attitude, sir, that calls for the most delicate judgment on both sides. Because as you know, sir, in the heat of action, men are likely to forget where their best interests lie and let their emotions carry them away.
Then the trick from my angle is to make my play strong enough to tie you up, but not make you mad enough to bump me off against your better judgment.
I guess you are a character.
6-2 and even, they're selling you out, sonny. I hope you're not letting yourself be influenced by the guns these pocket edition desperados are waving around. Because I've practiced taking guns away from these boys before, so we'll have no trouble there. Wilmer here is...
Right. Wilmer. 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 Wilmer.
There's our fall guy. Now, either you'll say yes right now, or I'll turn the fork in and the hole out of you.
Don't like that, sir.
You won't like it. Well?
You can have him.
There's a clip from the 1941 version of The Maltese Falcon starring Humphrey Bogart.
And I could have just listened to that whole film. I mean, what a difference. Anyone out there who were listening to those two side by side, it's engrossing. It's just fantastic difference. And it's all about the performance and about the music and about the pacing and about the way tension is built that you can even hear.
And this is a mistake that Hollywood makes over and over again, trying to remake a good film when, in fact, they should be remaking not so good films and improving them. And that would be a much better way to deal with your backlog of material.
But I do think there's something about the approach, too. Not only is Bogart a far better actor, but you have somebody made the decision that the villain and the good guy, that the detective and the villain would have some kind of equivalence. There would be symmetry in their intelligence. You can hear Sidney Greenstreet playing his back. You know, there was a great move on Bogart's part. Hey, kill me, and the whole thing is over. He said, well, you know, sometimes people are not terribly rational.
Right.
I mean, that's like, what do I do now? And that equivalence is what created tension, whereas if the good guy's always in the dominant role, you think, yeah, you're going to win, right?
But it's also the supporting actors who can create such vivid characterizations with a small amount of lines. I mean, the villain in the 1931 version is generic villain. And Sidney Greenstreet, even in that little bit of dialogue, you know, this by God, sir, you know, has created a character. And Peter Lorre in this film, too, has done a fabulous job with just a handful of lines.
And, you know, a thing that's interesting about thinking the Maltese Falcon such a superior version is, I mean, I don't know about you all, I've seen this film 30 times.
Yeah.
I still don't understand the plot.
No,
I mean, honestly,
it's
one of the most confusing films I've ever seen. And every time I watch it, I go, really? I don't understand. And the fact that it's such a great film and it makes no sense is a testament to these other qualities being as important as anything.
Detective movies never make that much sense, do they?
There's probably about another 30 minutes of that movie they got cut out. They would have explained everything. But it's like, we got to keep it to 90 minutes. Hey, I'd like to go to the phones right now and take a caller who also would like to chime in on this Best and Worst remakes. And for that, I will talk to Eric on the line from Burlington. Hi, Eric.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My favorite remake by far is the Tony Scott remake of Man on Fire with Denzel Washington, Dakota Fanning, and Christopher Walken. The way they remade that film and just made it raw and built this character who was at the end of his road, and then his heart's won over by this little blonde girl who gets kidnapped, and he goes on a revenge rampage to, you know, justify, you know, everything that's happened to her.
Did you see the original?
Yeah, with Kris Kristofferson. I didn't really care for it. You know, I mean, it's a good film or whatever, but
the way
they remade that film, the soundtrack, the Nine Inch Nails, all of that, it just builds and builds and builds, and then there's a release. You know, I think of myself as a hard guy, but at the end of that film, I find myself getting teared up.
I'm curious, forgive me for interrupting so often, but I'm very curious to know why, if you didn't like the first one so much, you would actually go and see a remake.
I really like Denzel. I really like the Scott brothers. Everything they do, it's just, you know, they really bring emotion into a film, and it's just, it's just a great film all around.
Great stuff, Eric. Thank you so much for calling in from Burlington.
I haven't seen either of those.
Me either.
Yeah, so.
Yeah, it's a great film, great soundtracks, according to Eric, and kind of an interesting approach, too. And I think something we got to a second ago, which is sometimes actors just bring you to the film. You know they're going to do a good job, and so let's watch them do this. And to some extent, it's the trapeze act. Like, that one was lousy, but I bet with this actor, you know, let's see what happens to
right.
it. Well, let's go to your favorite, Laura. This is Bollywood, a remake of a Hollywood film. Tell us about Bang Bang.
So I love Bollywood movies. I've talked about this before, and they are shameless in stealing from the entire history of Hollywood. And many times I'll be watching a movie, oh, this is Angels with Dirty Faces. Oh, this is An Affair to Remember. But as coming into the modern day, studios have partnered with Indian companies, and now the remakes are getting closer and closer. So Bang Bang is a remake with Hrithik Roshan and Katrina Kaif of a Tom Cruise and Cameron Diaz movie called Night and Day. And when my daughter saw it in New York, there was even a slide at the beginning crediting the writers of Night and Day, which was removed by the time it got here and is not on the DVD. But it is a pretty close remake of this action comedy.
It is an action comedy indeed. Let's hear a clip from Bang Bang.
Rajveer Nanda, international criminal, mentally unstable. Mujhe psychiatric help ki zarurat
hai.
You're in shock. Bang, bang.
Love the way Indian movies adapt Hollywood movies to their own culture. And there were many things that I thought must be Bollywood, like the amount of screaming that the heroine does. But in fact, Cameron Diaz screams even more.
Okay.
And there's some lazy plotting that I thought they just gave up. And then when I saw the original version, the plotting was even more lazy. So
no, the one thing about the Indian films, Bollywood films, especially with action, I was treated to a film called Kabale, starring a Tamil star known as Rajini, who's been a star since like the 1970s.
Yes, yes.
He's an action hero. I'm not an action film guy. I loved every second of it. I couldn't take my eyes off of it. He was great, but the cutting, the pace, the soundtrack, you just can't stop watching. I mean, that part they get right?
Absolutely
true.
These films have so much fun with their material.
Right.
I mean, that's part of it.
Right.
And it's hard as an audience member not to take that energy and just have a good time with what they're doing with the material.
That's the point
indeed.
They get it.
Well, speaking of foreign films, you did it to us as well, Marcia. You managed to find a Japanese version of A Fistful of Dollars, a quintessentially American movie.
Actually, it is the other way around.
Are you kidding?
This is a very interesting story.
Yes.
So Fistful of Dollars, 1964, this is the first of a trilogy of spaghetti westerns that were directed by the Italian director Sergio Leone in Spain, by and large. And it is actually a remake of an Akira Kurosawa film called Yojimbo from 1961. And they are both, I think, wonderful films. They're both films about a corrupt town who's in need of help. So you have Toshiro Mifune, the great Kurosawa actor, as a samurai in the Kurosawa film. You have Clint Eastwood as, of course, a cowboy. And what they share is that they have these central characters who aren't like good or bad. They're these kind of marginal moral figures. It's not clear what side they're on. Not particularly
the
heroic.
The masterless samurai.
Exactly. And both have really good comedic one-liners. So let's
listen. Well, let's listen. You've got to set this up, though, because this is the, it looks like the American Western town. You can almost see the tumbleweed, in the Kurosawa film. You can hear the wind whistling in the background.
Yes.
But they're wearing like these Japanese garb, like kimono-like things.
Yeah.
And they're wielding swords.
Yeah.
Instead of guns. I will say that an arm is detached in this scene, so that's
super
the
violent.
Yelling. Very, very violent. And
I'm playful.
And so, and I will translate for you the last line after you hear this clip.
では、顔毛2つ。いや、多分3つだ。
That's pretty much how that scene ends. The Kurosawa film Yojimbo remade, a remake of Fistful of Dollars. I will say the last line is he's walking away. He's severed the arm of, he's killed two guys. He's severed the arm of one of his opponents. And what he's saying to, by the way, the guy he's calling to, his name is Cooper.
Yeah.
So this is according to the subtitle. Cooper, two caskets. Then he turns and looks at the scene. Maybe three.
Make it three. And again, I want to clarify, Yojimbo came first. Fistful of Dollar is what was what remakes it. And I don't know if we're going to listen to a clip for that or not, but let me just say that I think it's super interesting to watch a European film made in a super American genre. This is a Western.
Right.
That is about the frontier between the United States and Mexico, that is based on a Japanese film that is basically indebted to that same genre. So there's just all of these kind of cross-cultural exchanges. And, you know, John Sturges made The Magnificent Seven based on Kurosawa's Seven Samurai. So this is not the only film to have taken Kurosawa and turned into a
Western. What do you think it was that Kurosawa saw, because this does have, I would say, again, a quintessentially American Western feel. What was it that he saw in that kind, in that genre, and in those themes?
He saw a lot of connections, I think, between aspects of American culture and Japanese culture, and he liked to link the kind of feudal Japanese samurai culture to things that were happening in the U.S. He was also a big fan of pulp novels. I mean, he adapted pulp. He adapted Shakespeare. I mean, so Kurosawa is looking everywhere for inspiration, and then he takes it, and he does these amazing original things that then people come back and imitate in other contexts.
And, of course, The Hidden Fortress was a big influence on Star Wars, so
right.
Kurosawa influenced all kinds of different genres. I have to say, come down on the side of Yojimbo is my preference.
Ah.
Mm.
Definitely.
It is, but for an American, I will say, it does have a comic effect. I mean, you have a hard time taking it seriously.
Well, it's meant
because
to be
it
funny.
Looks like it's satirized.
It's well, a
it,
comedy, it, it, too.
I mean, certainly
it has
Fistful of Dollars
element.
Does that. I mean,
yes,
right, there's the over-the-top,
the
one-liners, yeah. But again, if you see it, you know, with that kind of costuming and only using swords, you think, oh, this is just designed as a satire of Fistful of Dollars, but as you say,
No.
That was the original. Marcia Gordon, film professor at North Carolina State, Laura Boyes, film curator at North Carolina's Museum of Art. Thank you both for being on the program.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Next time on Movies on the Radio, we want to know what is your pick for the best superhero film, SOT@WUNC.org. Tweet us at #SOTMovie. Your best superhero film. We'll talk about that the next time. And, of course, you can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. State of Things produced by Anita Rao, Charlie Shelton-Ormond, Laura Pelliser, and Jennifer Brooklyn. Robin Copley is our technical director. Al Wodarski is sitting in today. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacio.